meeting on early childhood and youth development will come to order. And the first bill on the calendar is Representative Dabney's 353. The chair will move House File 353 and to pass and be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. Go ahead with and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard as it makes its way through the process. I know that this committee has looked in depth at issues related to children's mental health, and I appreciate that. It lays a solid base for the rationale for this bill. What we find is that there is significant need in our schools for greater access to school-based mental health providers as part of the continuum of care that is available in the schools, school counselors, school social workers, and then looking to school-based mental health providers who are not school staff, but bring in another level of expertise. It increases access for children and families to those providers and works to reduce some of the stigma as well as reducing other barriers to access to mental health services, such as a parent needing to take off in the middle of the day, get to the children's school, get the child to a clinic. Those can be real impediments to some children. And as I'm sure this committee has looked at, there is significant demonstrated evidence that this is a positive, not only in terms of the mental health of students and the orderly behavior in schools, but also of academic achievement. What we're seeing in the education reform area is kind of an emerging new generation of education reform that looks at the quality of relationships between students and between adults in the school and students as a key lever in closing the achievement gap. Mr. Chair, with me today I do have Hennepin County Commissioner Gail Dorfman. I believe in members' packets, perhaps Mr. Smith can confirm, you do have a map indicating, thank you, sir, indicating where across the state we have school-linked mental health services. As you can see, they're widely distributed across the state, the northeast portion of the state, the northwest, southwest Minnesota has a strong presence here. There are some significant gaps, however. The Anoka-Hennepin School District, for instance, has no school-based mental health professionals, even though that school district was noted as a site of contagion for adolescent suicide a few years ago by the Minnesota Department of Health. So widely dispersed across the state based on the grant process currently in place, but also some gaps that I hope we can work together and fill this year. With that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to Commissioner Dorfman.
Thank you, Representative Dabney, and I recognize Commissioner Dorfman, and that sure doesn't look like Sue Aberhold next to you. It looks like a person that works for Minneapolis schools. Go ahead, Commissioner Dorfman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, and members of the committee. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to testify in support of House File 353. I'm joined by Dr. Mark Sander, who's a Hennepin County employee, but who heads up our school-based mental health initiative. So he's also jointly employed by the school district, Minneapolis Schools, right now. So almost a decade ago, I was really pleased to be part of Governor Pawlenty's bipartisan mental health action group, which was a broad-based coalition that created a roadmap to reforming our mental health system here in Minnesota. And reform to us meant creating a consumer-centered mental health system that provided the right care at the right time in the right setting, a system that was less fragmented, less complicated, more cost-effective, and ultimately easier for people to navigate. And one of the key recommendations coming out of that effort was around children's mental health, and it was about pairing mental health and education, resulting in state grants that, beginning in 2008, helped implement the school-based mental health initiative here in Minnesota. In Hennepin County, we're now in 80 schools across the county, serving about 2,300 kids annually in grades K-12. And again, Dr. Mark Sander heads up that program and is here to answer any questions you have for him. So here's what we've seen and measured by having mental health care in our schools. Attendance is up, Dropouts are down. School suspensions are down. Teachers are better prepared to deal with children in the classroom who have behavioral issues. They send fewer kids to the principal's office. And we believe fewer children are referred to special ed programs for behavioral problems. Kids who get the mental health care they need do better in school. By meeting children where they're at, in a place where they feel safe, a place where there's less stigma, a place that's easy to access, as Representative Dabney spoke to, it benefits students. It benefits teachers, the classroom, and the overall school environment. And families like it too. I've seen young people who were picked up by the police for low-level crimes standing in front of a judge where their frantic parents begged the judge to throw them in jail so their child could finally get, or so they hope, the mental health care and treatment the child so needed. That's not how to provide the right care at the right time in the right setting. The right model is to intervene much, much earlier in our school buildings. On the cost side, over 75% of all mental health treatment provided in the schools is reimbursed as a result of a partnership we've built through the county, the schools, and mental health providers who have contractual relationships with health plans. But state funding is still needed to pay for the unreimbursed portion of care, which includes a really important collaboration between the mental health providers and various school personnel. It's an essential part of making this all work. The governor's budget also proposes new reimbursements for care coordination, which would really go a long way toward making school-based mental health sustainable in the future. So thank you again to Representative Dabney and Governor Dayton for supporting legislation that increases state funding for school mental health care. Yesterday I was with Senator Franken at a school in North Minneapolis, the Elizabeth Hall School, and it's one of our Hennepin County schools where we have a full-time mental health provider. The principal and the teachers told us that it has transformed that school. The senator has introduced a bill in Congress that would also expand federal funding for school-based mental health programs. Bottom line, the evidence is in. There's a direct connection between mental health care, school success, and creating an effective children's mental health system here in Minnesota. We look forward to working with the governor and working with all of you to ensure that mental health care is available to every child who needs it in every school in Hennepin County and in every school across the state. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Sander, is it? Are you speaking or just answering?
I'm just here to answer questions.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, Representative Meyer has a question.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, I'll put these together. Would you please define school-linked mental health services and then also just go and talk a little bit about the type of services that would be provided for children?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sander.
Dr. Sanders has a doctor in front of his name and I don't.
Oh, okay.
Which I think immediately puts him much higher qualified to answer Representative Myra's questions authoritatively.
Dr. Sander.
Sure, thank you. Chair, Representative. So I think the definition of school-linked mental health for us in Hennepin County, and I think in the past through the RFP and the grants, is really taking a mental health agency and having that mental health agency partner with the school district and then bring in a licensed mental health professional to provide clinical mental health services on-site at the school or at least linked to the school. It varies a little bit, but oftentimes some of the work is done on-site at the school. And in terms of services, you've got the clinical services, which is going to be a diagnostic assessment, individual, family, group therapy, those kinds of skills, also CTSS services. And then there's what the grant also pays for is that consultation time. So consulting with teachers and school social workers and school administrators and doing the care coordination, which is just really vital to keeping this service strong and robust for the families and students.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. If I may expand just a little bit on what Dr. Sanders said. One of the important pieces of the grant program is that it pays for that consultative work by the providers. The providers can bill health insurance, whether it's public or private, for the therapeutic services that they provide. but they can't, the insurance companies won't pay for that consultative time with school staff, and yet the child spending 6, 7, 8 hours a day there, having coordination between the care plan that has been developed and is being implemented by the mental health professional and the school staff can be critical in the value the child experiences and the support the child receives that otherwise will not happen because it won't be reimbursed without the grant program.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just add too, we heard from one of the teachers at Elizabeth Hall yesterday who said not only does he now know how to better handle kids with problems within the classroom, but even better is that there were kids who were being sent out to community-based mental health care and they'd miss a whole day of school in order to do that. And now they can just walk down the hall, see the mental health provider, and be in class a half hour later.
For the record, that was Commissioner Dorfman. She doesn't believe in waiting.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, identifying that a number of these issues are out in outstate greater Minnesota, what part of these grants and funds will be placed out in greater Minnesota? And have we identified those locations, or how will those locations be chosen?
Representative Downey, I think you're getting a lifeline without right. even asking for it.
I love that. Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I would refer you to the map that is in your packet. I think that answers quite a bit of your question, but Ms. Abderholden can go further.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Abderholden, Nowy, Minnesota. Yes, you'll see the grantees on the far left side of the map, and the way this program works is that the mental health providers apply for funding to the state, and they collaborate with their schools. So quite a few of these programs are in greater Minnesota, and we do have community mental health centers covering all 87 counties.
Okay, thank you.
Follow up?
Oh, Representative. Follow
thank
up.
You. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how do they identify those schools? I mean, because I know when you've got a block on a county, some of those counties are quite large, and there's a host of school districts within that county. So, and some of them are a great distance apart from wherever that mental health facility is. How does that connect?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howe, partly what the providers have done is kind of work with schools that they might already be collaborating with. Clearly, they can't cover all of them, which is, you know, part of our effort here is to increase the dollars so that they can cover more schools. A lot of them have focused on particularly, perhaps middle schools or high schools where you start to see emerging mental illnesses in particular to focus there. But again, one of the problems is we haven't had enough money to cover all the schools.
Thank you. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I have a question for Representative Dabney, but you might want to refer to a doctor. Punt. There's a doctor in the house. You're an honest man. So it kind of relates to the allocation of resources in metro versus outstate, and really trying to get at where that will be. I guess my first question would be, where are we at now? I know you refer to the chart here, but that doesn't tell me what the current allocation is. I imagine there's probably an issue with the current allocation because you have the language in the bill saying that 25% has to go to the highest percentage of special ed and so forth. That tends to be in the urban area, but not exclusively, obviously. But so, how do we allocate the funds now? How would you say we've allocated it in the current three-year cycle, effective February 2009?
We're deciding who best to answer that question. Oh, and we might call somebody else down yet.
Your lifeline is asking for a lifeline.
Why not?
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Abderholden?
Mr. Cox is coming down. My understanding is that everyone who applied, except for one, got funding. So they tried to make sure that every, mental health organization that applied got some funding, and there was just one proposal that just, didn't cut it, basically, so they didn't get funds. But I'm going to let Mr. Cox from the Children's Mental Health Division
answer
Mr.
it more.
Mr. Cox, could you state your name and answer the question?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Cox with the Children's Mental Health Division at DHS. Ms. Aperholen pretty much answered the question. It was by application, and the distribution that we were allowed to make was by those who were applied. So could you, I'm sorry, could you
repeat the question? Sure.
Yeah. Representative Vera.
I'm not sure I can. but my interest is in understanding the current allocation of resources between metro and rural. And I reference the current bill of 1.9, lines 1.9, referencing 25%. Just trying to understand, I have a couple questions. This is the first one. But the first one is, how are we allocating our resources currently between metro and rural?
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it pretty much is by the ability of the providers in those communities who applied for the grant, establishing relationships with the different school districts, as many as they can. I mean, as you know, it's not just the number of school districts in a county, it's also the number of schools within the school district. The community provider establishing relationships with the schools and the school districts will try to evaluate the best distribution of their resources within that provider service area. And then what we hope to do with this proposal then is to expand that, which presumably would require hiring a few new practitioners and developing those relationships further. I'd have to say that it does require some amount of technical assistance on the part of the state, because providing clinical mental health services in schools is a pretty new thing for a lot of school districts. Mm-hmm. They're not quite sure how to do it. They're not quite sure how to do the third party billing, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Once they get that kind of technical knowledge, then it's a lot easier to expand those services into new schools and school districts.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baird, you also asked about the 25%.
Not yet.
Well, you referenced it.
Yes.
And just to clarify, that only applies to the new funding. So the funding that's already providing services in 59 of Minnesota's greater Minnesota counties and 6 of its metro counties would not be covered by that 25%. That 25% would only apply to the new funding.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Barrett.
Good segue into my question about the 25%. So looking at the line and really trying to understand what that accomplishes, I know generically what it accomplishes, and I agree with the principle, but I'm just wondering how, I'm wondering about it. Says then at least 25% of the new funding shall be targeted to providers that can serve schools and have the highest percentage of special education students. How do we define highest percentage? I mean, are we talking the highest percentage, the highest, the one highest, or the top 10% or the top 15%? I guess I'm not sure what that exactly means, so I'm not sure how those funds could be allocated in a certain way without really having a good definition.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Baird. As you know from serving on the Education Policy Committee, we track percentages of special education students across the state.
Right. Yeah.
By district. Yeah. We could come up with the numbers for your two districts if you gave me time to look for it. So we have that information. They tend to be located in regional centers across the state. There tends to be a greater ability of regional centers to provide special education services. And so even if a child is born in a smaller community, the family may move to the nearest regional center because they're able to get better special education services for their student.
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Aperholen,
if I can add to that. Part of the reason of targeting just a small percentage of the new funding was also to address some of the issues, for example, that the intermediate districts face, and that they have high percentage of not just special education, but children who are classified as emotionally behavioral disorders, because they tend to have mental illnesses and need to receive treatment, along with the high use of prone restraints, which actually came out of the seclusion restraint report from the Department of Education You had all received it amongst your numerous emails and reports about a week and a half ago. And one of their recommendations was to make sure that where we have a student where prone restraints is being used frequently, that we need some kind of pot of money, if you will, to bring those intensive services into that child so that we don't have to continue to use it. So we didn't want all of the money allocated in this way, but just a small percentage, again, knowing that these are students that are most likely to have a serious mental illness.
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative Barrett.
Sure, and I don't mean to belabor the point. I'm just trying to understand what will actually happen when the bill gets, if it gets approved and gets adopted and money starts flowing. Just trying to understand what the intent here is here and how we measure it, really. I'm still not sure how we measure highest percentage of special ed students. I mean, again, is it if you go down the list and you have a top five, is it the top five, top 10? And I'm still not sure how anyone from the department can look at that and say, we've accomplished our goal. Can anyone from the department say that, yeah, we can measure this pretty easily, that 25% is going to go to the highest percentage of special ed? Maybe I'm not reading the language right, and that could be, but.
Mr. Condon.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barrett, for the purposes of expansion, yeah, I mean, we can look at the highest percentage. I mean, I presume we would do it with the highest percentage by school district, and those numbers are, we can get those numbers from the Department of Education, and then I presume what we would do would be with the new money, the money that's specifically allocated to that purpose, we would go down the list until the money was gone, presuming that we had applicants from that area.
Just a final statement. I guess I would ask that you clarify the language so we know exactly who qualifies under the definition highest percentage of special ed students categorized as EBD, high poverty or high use. Seems pretty unclear, so I don't know how you can implement it when it's so unclear. That's my only point. Don't have an amendment. Just would give you that encouragement.
Thank you. Speaking of amendments, we have two here. Representative Myra, are they both yours? A3 and A1, is that correct?
Yes, A1 and A3 are my amendments.
Representative Myra, do you want to, I'll take them as A3 first. Do you want to move your A3 amendment?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move amendment A3 to House File 353. It, on page 1, line 14, after the period, insert, for purposes of these appropriations, a third-party reimbursement source does not include a public school within the meaning under Minnesota Statute Section 120A.20. Subdivision 1. And that just clarifies the language. That would include charter schools, ALCs, and such.
Representative Dabney, do you have an opinion on this amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Myra, thank you for bringing this forward. My understanding of third-party billing isn't schools. It's insurance companies. So I appreciate this and would urge members to support the amendment.
Thank you. I don't think, since we're running out of time, I don't think we have to discuss it any more than this one. All in favor of the A3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Myra, do you want to move your A1? Then?
Mr. Chair, I do. I move amendment A1 to House File 353. On page 1, line 9, delete everything after the period and insert the commissioner shall target the new funding to, and then on line 12, delete everything after restraints and insert, and ensure that grants are distributed proportionally to rural and urban counties.
Okay. Representative Dabney, do you have an opinion on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Myra, thank you for bringing this amendment forward. I would ask members to oppose this amendment. Representative Barrett raised some issues about clarity in the drafting. This amendment actually makes the bill less clear in terms of interpretation and application, and I'm concerned about that. And I'm concerned about, by fencing off funding, we are not following either children's needs or clinicians' ability to respond to those needs, and instead are building fences that aren't helpful to our students. So I would ask for a no vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Okay, then all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
No. It is. It fails. Thank you. Is there any final argument then on the bill or anything like that? Okay. Then the chair renews his motion to pass House File 353 as amended, and it be referred to Health and Human Services Finance, correct?
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chair.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Representative Lane. Representative Lane, I assume you move your own bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 359 pass and be referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
Thank you, Representative Lane. Go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. This bill includes four parts, and the first part has to do with when youth are transitioning out of the children's mental health system at age 18, and there's nothing magical about 18, so sometimes it's a very hard transition. We would like to have them have the option to continue on until they decide to leave, until they reach age 26. And there is some concern at the county level, but that is going to be worked on, I believe, tomorrow, some of the details that go with that. But that's the first part, is just nothing magical about 18. And then Section 2 refers to a small building in Wilmer that holds the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services. It has the safety net for children with very high needs, particularly more violent and difficult behaviors, and it's very small, serving about 14 kids. It's time to look at this program and see if this is the most effective use of our resources. So it's asking the commissioner to develop recommendations and legislation regarding this use. And Section 3 refers to entities called psychiatric residential treatment centers. We don't have any in the state of Minnesota, but these are a very intensive level of care for children and adolescents with serious emotional disturbances, very complex situations. And we would want a work group to look at developing standards for establishing these here in Minnesota so that we don't have to send our children out of state or just have them in detention facilities. And part four is appropriations for five different things. So the first one is training for mental health, crisis services for crisis teams through in every county. We don't have these across the county right now, so across all the counties right now, so we want community health workers training for crisis teams to meet recognize children's mental health problems. And subdivision two deals with mental health first aid, so that we train some people, they train other people in the state to know what to do in a crisis. And this is actually a provision in President Obama's proposal to reduce gun violence. Subdivision 3 revolves around respite care for families. Subdivision 4 is to expand children's mental health crisis services to more counties and tribes, get community health workers out and about. And Section 4, then Subdivision 5, I mean, is then the same thing that Representative Dabney was just relating to. Has to do with school-linked mental health services grants to providers who collaborate with the schools. And since you just discussed that, I won't go any further on that one.
Okay. Ms. Abterholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abterholden, NAMI, Minnesota. We obviously support this bill. This is one of the 12 bills that has been created to try to address some of the problems and, you know, fractures in our children's mental health system. I just want to reiterate that we know that the counties have a problem with Section 1. We are meeting tomorrow morning to try to work with them to figure out how to make this work so that everybody's happy and singing kumbaya. I will mention that under the mental health first aid training, we currently do mental health first aid training on adult mental illnesses. It is becoming a very accepted, excellent practice, so that, you know, kind of like learning CPR and first aid. It's kind of, so how do you deal with someone who's having a mental health crisis? And this new training is now being applied to children. It just really got released in January of this year by the National Council for Behavioral Health. And it's an excellent training program, so we want to make sure that we get it going here for even folks like school resource officers. And then the community health workers are really a way to address mental health care disparities. About 2 years ago, the legislature did allow community health workers to operate, to be supervised by a mental health professional, but a lot of them feel like they don't have enough training in mental health to do this. This is another training program that was again developed by the National Council for Behavioral Health. I have worked with the local community health workers here in Minnesota. They're very anxious to have this training, and as you can see, it's not a lot of money. It's $15,000 to carry that out. We have two people to testify on crisis services, so I'm going to not talk about them and let them talk about it, if that's okay.
Are you Ms. Bennett or Dr. Pitkin? Are these... Were the lineups that you submitted to the umpires before the game wrong and you're substituting already? Who are you?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Bennett.
Oh, okay.
My son Jack is almost 11 and I speak about him with his permission. Jack has exhibited symptoms of mental illness since he was a toddler. By 10, he was diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, a mood disorder, ADHD, anxiety, depression, oppositional defiance disorder, and sensory integration disorder. Between the ages of 6 and 10, most of our days contained several severe tantrums or outbursts, and they would often last for hours. There was frequent damage to our home, and our entire life was held hostage to his mood swings. Managing his education, even with a great team, was a challenge. And in May of 2012, there was an incident in the classroom which his teacher, who was a seasoned special education and also regular education teacher of 20 years, described as the scariest incident of her entire career. There were a few places that we could turn for help. We couldn't dial 911 every time he had a meltdown. We couldn't take him to the emergency room every time because we'd be going several times a week. At night and at the weekend, we were alone because there was no way to contact a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or a therapist for help. At these times, when there was nowhere else to turn except for calling 911, we called the county crisis team. We had immediate access to a mental health professional when we were at our breaking point, and many, many times they were able to talk through the situation and help us identify a way to de-escalate it. We were committed to stabilizing our son in our home and preventing hospitalization where possible, and the crisis team enabled us to do that. Quite honestly, there were times we just needed to know they were there. They do have a mobile unit, and I think many times that would have been extremely useful, but they have limited staff, and on the occasions when we could have used that, they just were not able to come. My most recent call to the crisis line came when my son was going through a med change in summer of last year, following months of extreme violence and aggression. He was strangely calm. In fact, he seemed depressed that day. Following an argument over his choice of a snack, he went into the garage and came back with a hammer and told me he was going to kill me. He didn't really put up a fight when I took the hammer from him, which was kind of unusual, but a short while later, he came downstairs with his favorite bear, his blanket, and he went out and lay in the street in the dark. When I went outside and brought him back in, he told me he was waiting for a car to come and squash him. The next morning, I called the crisis team as soon as he started to become agitated. We both felt that he needed to go to the hospital, but we were concerned that they wouldn't admit him if he was not in a full-blown mental health crisis and actually able to be driven. But after discussing the events of the previous night, the crisis team advised me to immediately take him to the emergency room to tell them exactly what I had just said and to say the crisis team advised me to go. This gave me the confidence and the encouragement I needed to go to the hospital despite hearing the endless stories of kids being sent home because they de-escalated by the time they see a doctor. I urge you to give your support to increasing funding so that crisis services can be provided to more families. More staff and more availability of mobile units who can go to a family in their home would reduce the number visiting emergency rooms, but also ensure that children who urgently need help receive it when the families are overwhelmed, exhausted, and helpless. I also urge you to support increased funding for respite care. Caregiver stress is proven to be extremely high in families raising a child with special needs, and especially so when a child has an emotional or behavioral disorder. Parenting should not involve being bitten, punched, kicked, pushed downstairs, and verbally abused relentlessly. Parenting should not result in parents developing depression or anxiety, or in some cases, PTSD, simply from raising a child. But when it does, being able to access respite for the child and know they are safe while you recuperate mentally and physically, and access community resources to help yourself and your child is crucial. Thank you for giving me the chance to speak today.
Thank you. Would you state your name for the
record? Yes, my name is Dr. Kate Hinn, and I manage crisis services at Hennepin County and would like to speak on behalf of crisis services, describe the services, talk a little bit about how they are operated in Hennepin County, and discuss the interest in being able to have these services statewide.
Go ahead.
Okay. Crisis services are 24/7, 365-day mobile mental health emergency services with a goal to address crises when and where they occur, allowing youth to remain in their homes, schools, and communities. About 85% of the youth seen by the crisis team are diverted from hospitalization and being put in detention. And while we know that the majority of people with mental health issues are not dangerous, the crisis team can play a key role in preventing public safety issues for children who are untreated. These might include suicide, homicide, or terroristic threats. We've seen them all in the crisis teams and feel that that's a special service that is not duplicated elsewhere in the service system. In Hennepin County, one-third of the youth that we see in the crisis team are immediately suicidal. The crisis team has trained over 500 parents so far to be able to restrict children's access to articles that they could use to harm themselves, including weapons and medications. In Hennepin County, the largest share of referrals come from parents, but the schools are second in the listing of referral sources, providing us with about one-third of our client referrals. The services that are provided to schools include in-school crisis intervention, so when the school has exhausted its own internal resources, it can call the crisis team out to come and do further de-escalation. We've had some episodes where groups of children have planned to commit suicide during the school day in front of their classmates, and the crisis team comes in and addresses that. We send a group of people out to do that kind of thing. So we believe we've prevented a number of very serious situations from developing in our area schools as well as in the community. I think in terms of utility to the family, you've heard a little bit about that, but I also just wanted to say that the short wait time and flexibility of crisis services fits very well for today's busy families, and especially families that are raising children with mental health issues. Crisis services are available at convenient locations and times for families and are private if people choose not to go to a clinic or to be seen in their school-based mental health services or elsewhere in the community. They can have services in their home privately. No one needs to know that they're receiving mental health services if they are concerned about that issue. For families who are concerned about stigma or experience problems with access to health care, the easy access of crisis services is a positive solution to that problem. And in Hennepin County, service requests have risen for a variety of language groups and communities of color over the time that the crisis services have been in operation. Research demonstrates that early mental health service can prevent more severe illness later in life. Crisis services can be the gateway to ongoing services for families who have problems with accessing services in their communities. And it solves both the current issue of mental health problems at the time, and then it also prevents the longer-term effects of having untreated mental health issues into adulthood for some people. And then in terms of statewide needs, the mission of crisis service is not unique to any county. All the counties have children who have untreated or undertreated mental illness, difficulties in accessing care, problems that occur outside of the scope of business hours, and crisis periods in their illness, as well as children who represent a harm to themselves or others. The crisis teams serve whoever is present in their county on a particular day, regardless of their county of origin, and then refer clients back to their home county for further follow-up. And having a statewide network of crisis services allows much more ease of access across county lines. And we really do in our metro area manage the service regionally and have had great success in doing this. Availability of mobile crisis services statewide will also be needed if there is an interest in supporting a statewide text suicide prevention service. If we have a text for life service in our state, the absolute next step for this is to have mobile crisis as backup. Otherwise, we'll be identifying people who need help and having no solution for them except an ambulance or a police car transport. And then in terms of the question of why adult workers would need to have training in child crisis, I just came from a meeting before coming here where people were talking about, I wish we had some training for our adult workers to be able to learn how to do child crisis. And I mentioned to them that the legislature was considering that very fact. They were astonished to hear that and pleased to hear the forward-thinking legislation that is being proposed here. I also want to say the developmental framework that is used by the child crisis workers is really essential to mental health work with children. The person needs to be able to understand the difference between developmental challenges versus actual mental health issues and how those two coincide, and then also need to be able to communicate very effectively with children in order to effectively assess and treat children in need. Also, engagement with families is an important component of mental health services, and adult clinicians are typically not well trained in how to do that with between parents and children and need that type of training. Also, some preliminary research findings indicate that there are poorer outcomes for children who are served by adult clinicians, and that these interactions tend to end up with law enforcement intervention more frequently than with a child clinician. So this is an important component of the bill that may seem questionable, but I think there is strong support both in terms of our clinical experience and now the developing research base to suggest that there are specialties and there's a reason to have specialties for this type of service. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Pitkin. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on this? Okay. Then there's two amendments, I believe. Take the amendments first. Representative Meyer, are these your amendments again?
Mr. Chair, I would like to withdraw Amendment 2.
Oh, okay. And so then
I would like to move Amendment 4.
Representative Meyer removes the A4 amendment. And could you real briefly explain it?
Yes. On page 3, line 17, after the period, insert, a third-party reimbursement source does not include a public school within the meaning under Minnesota Statute Section 120A.20, Subdivision 1. The commissioner may not require a public school to incur any additional financial obligations as a result of a grant under this paragraph.
Thank you. Representative Lane, do you recommend or?
The same as when Representative Dabney spoke of this. We don't know of any situation where this is happening, so there's no problem with saying this.
So this amendment is okay with the author of the bill?
Right.
Okay. Any other discussion? Okay. Then all in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? No. Carries. Did you have a question, or was it just to move the amendment?
Question.
Okay. Then Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lane, how is quality treatment measured?
Representative Lane, or
I will pass it on to Ms. Abderholden.
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chair, Representative Meyer. You know, the department collects a lot of data. I don't know which. Are you referring to the crisis teams or schooling or?
Mr. Chair, on line 2.16, it says the treatment provided at the facility is high quality, effective treatment.
Ms.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I wasn't sure where in the bill you were. What we want to make sure of there is, and again, we're pulling everyone together. It's a small program, you know, out in Willmar. We want to look at family satisfaction. We want to look at evidence-based practices. So those are all things that go into whether it's a quality service or not.
Representative Meyer? Okay. Seeing no further questions. Representative Lane renews her motion to pass House File 359 as amended and refer it to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, no. Carries. And with that, the meeting's adjourned.